the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, to the Sangha. I'm going to take a few minutes here, and I want to make some kind of general comments about heaven, since we're talking about kind of a heaven, really, a Buddha land, where that's the context in which our master's experience is happening at this point that we've got to. I want to talk a little bit about heaven. And I'll start by talking a little bit about hell, because well, we're most of us more familiar with that, aren't we? But you know, what would you say is the chief characteristic of hell? You know, the chief characteristic of hell. We all really know it. That, it's you feel awful. You feel totally awful. That's what characterizes hell. You know, you feel totally awful. And you can't divorce hell from that feeling of total awfulness. You know, there wouldn't be a hell for you if you were in it and didn't feel totally awful. It'd be hell for someone else, maybe, but not necessarily for you. You might be making it hell for someone else. I don't know, but, you know, that's true for heaven in the reverse, you know. You can't be in heaven and be feeling totally awful. You know, you gotta be feeling blissful in heaven. Or at least, you know, deeply content. Which is a kind of quiet bliss, really. You know, freedom from craving is a kind of quiet bliss in itself. So, you know, it's easy to get caught up in the external appearances of a particular heaven or a particular hell. And the way I view it is the eternal is quite capable of customizing each hell and each heaven for each of us and our need. You know. Another thing about, let's start with hell again, since this tends to be more familiar territory, but, you know, feeling, you know, really hell is a state of unrelieved pain, physical pain or spiritual pain or both, and quite, not just mild pain, but severe pain. And, what are those pure states of feeling? They're a karmic consequence coming due. They're one of the ways, you know, painful feelings are one of the ways in which karmic consequence comes due. Also, you can have blissful feelings. Another way in which karmic consequence can come due. So hell is a karmic consequential state, or realm. And heaven is also karmic consequential. When you're experiencing heaven, you're reaping some merit in feeling. When you're experiencing hell, you're reaping some of the precepts-breaking type of karma in feeling. It's all perfectly logical. And if you think about it again, for me individually, you know, heaven's going to be no consolation and no fun at all if I'm sitting there miserable, totally miserable. So, you know, you might say, well, one person's heaven might be another person's hell. But if you look at how to grow lotus blossom, the earlier stages involve some hells, and not pleasant hells either. And you could see how they were customized to the particular karma being dealt with. I can see it anyway. And so with the heaven here. Here now some serious merits being reaped. So let's go back to hell again to kind of continue this little comparison. I wouldn't want to carry anything too far, but it does have its uses thinking along these lines, I think. So think of, okay, so what is it to train in hell? You know, there's a saying in Soto Zen, at any rate. I don't know if other schools of Buddhism have this saying or not. I bet they all have some version of it. But the kindest Kanzan appears in hell. And I've always found this in my life. And this isn't to say I ever liked hell. I've never liked hell. But when I've experienced, you know, intense, for me it's always been, you know, really spiritual suffering. When I experience intense suffering, it's really been a huge incentive to really get in there and really concentrating in meditation. Really, it really squeezes the cry for help out of you like nothing else does. And it's a, there's a great teaching in the midst of hell. What is it that Kanzan is? Kanzan represents cosmic compassion. Kanzan is cosmic compassion, the compassion of the eternal. So what is it to say that the kindest Kanzan appears in hell? That right in the midst of the hell is the compassion. That pain itself is a compassion if we will turn towards it and open our heart and really sit still. And there's no place you get educated like in hell. There's no place you get educated like in hell. You get educated the meaning of faith, what faith really is, your own capacity for faith. You get educated as the nature of your own humanity and of the humanity of others. I give a little example of this. I've told about this little couple days of hell that I went through in 1998 when this particular past life that had come up many years before, when it came up in the more kind of purely karmic consequential form of it, the profound sense of worthlessness and deep self-judgment of the person whose karma I inherited came up. And that person had committed suicide. And boy, for those 2 days, I it was the first time in my life I ever thought suicide really looked good. I was really experiencing with what that person felt. It was hell. It was true hell. And at that time, I thought of one of my fellow monks who I knew suffered really deeply at times, and really deeply. And I thought, you know, I'm always going to view this individual differently now. And an enormous sense of respect grew in my heart at that time. It's kind of burgeoning in my heart, love and respect for that individual. Seeing, boy, some people really just the faith that that individual shows, just living daily life, training all these years. So, think of the teaching for me personally. And it's always remained for me a precious time of teaching, although. Awful, painful experience. And at the same time, precious. The two don't stand against one another. So there's teaching in hell. Deep teaching. Can it be that there is deep teaching in heaven as well? Yes. And it's like hell in that the teaching is there in hell. If you are, the teaching is there, and it is our responsibility, our choice, really, whether we will learn from it. It's possible to spend a lot of time in hell and not be learning, just be refusing to learn, refusing to look up in the midst of it, refusing to turn towards the eternal for help. Refusing to sit still. It's possible to go through hell and not learn much. Similarly, it's possible to go through heaven and not learn. Oh, and it is possible to learn. What makes it possible in hell to learn? Not pushing away. Not pushing away. accepting. What is it that makes it possible to learn in heaven? Not clinging. Not clinging. Don't push away the painful. Don't cling to the blissful. So what is it we see Reverend Master doing in the chapter that chapters we've been talking about? She realizes she's spending extended time here in a heaven, and she's realizing I could kind of hang out here or try to hang out here, and there's no point in that. I have to keep moving. I have to not try to hold on to anything. And just as when she was in hell, she stood up straight in the presence of the Buddha's ancestors, accepted responsibility, and really, really learned. So in heaven, she's doing this, the equivalent, the same basic thing. It manifests in a different, seemingly different choice. It's the same essential thing. That neither hell nor heaven is the point in itself. And one can train there. She's choosing to make it her training, both in hell and in heaven, and to continue her training. The focus is on the continued following of the eternal. And you see both in hell and in heaven, you see the same thing, turning towards in heaven, and in hell what came out, hold fast to the Lord of the house, whether I'm well or sick, brightly alive or dying, hold fast to the Lord of the house. Where do you learn that? You learn it in hell. You really learn it. That's where you get into your blood and bones. Ideally, we'd all be brighter than that and we'd learn it elsewhere. But in fact, we don't. We learn that in hell. That's where we get into our blood and bones. What is it in heaven? Again, she turns towards the eternal. She keeps checking. She keeps asking. She keeps turning towards the eternal. What is it that's good to do? Please show me the way. She's not taking anything for granted here. She's not sitting there patting herself on the back, look how holy I am because I made it to heaven here. Her focus is on what is it that's good to do? It isn't, in the end, it's not good to just kind of hang out. You need to keep fulfilling your genuine responsibility. Even if you've got one foot in heaven, so to speak, while you're alive in this body, you've got one foot on earth. And you've got to fulfill your earthly responsibility if you're going to train. I'm talking about it in this way and in this detail because it's so vitally important to what comes. If you remember that in her first encounter with heaven, the kind of flashing light flashing off the pillar, remember that back? She chose not to kind of take the reward, so to speak, and die at that point. She chose to keep going and to clean up the karma more deeply. She wasn't fully aware at that time, I think, that that was the choice she was making. But that was the choice she was making. She just was listening to her heart, and she knew that it was dangerous to go into that light. As a result of that choice, then the deeper karmic inheritance could reveal itself. The karmic inheritance, the deeper causes of suffering from the past lives could reveal themselves. It's right after that that happens. And the deeper going into the precepts. So it is that at the point we're at now in the narrative, River Master is choosing not to just hang out in heaven. And so there's this great flood of teaching that's going to be coming that I think probably wouldn't have come if she tried to hold on. I'm sure it couldn't have come if she tried to hold on to the ecstasy or hold on to the bliss. There's this great flood of teaching coming. Whether one is in hell or in heaven or in any other realm or any other state of feeling, any other state of volition, there are choices to be made, and our choices have real consequences. Our choices have real consequences. Reverend Master is giving a tremendous example in throughout How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, a tremendous example of continuing to choose to follow the eternal. Continuing to choose the going on beyond, always going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. To continue to choose to follow the path of the precepts, to continue to choose to be a responsible person. It said, and I believe I heard a master say it, that's maybe where I first heard it actually, that the real meaning of hell is separation from God. That's the real meaning of hell. And the way a Buddhist would put it is the real meaning of hell is the conviction that one is separate from God, from the love of God. And so the real meaning of heaven must be, in the deepest sense, must be the recognition that one is not separate from the love of the eternal. That one is not separate from God. And look at what is happening in the Buddha land that River Master visits. Look what is happening. So this, I'll just remind you of a few of the points here, because to me it's just an inexpressibly precious teaching being conveyed through these experiences. Just as precious here as in any of them. You know, teaching conveyed, not just a blissful experience, a teaching conveyed. In one vision, I see at least three clear ways in which Reverend Master is being taught about the love of the eternal, shown the love of the eternal. One way is with the fountain, the spring that comes up at the top of the hill as a fountain and flows down the hill. As I understand it, that is the water of the Spirit and the water of the love of the eternal. The flowing of the love of the eternal. Sometimes we see it and sometimes we don't. Sometimes it seems to be there and sometimes it doesn't. In actual fact, it's always present. And everything, every time we experience it, we are enlivened by it. Remember, she says that when the stream stops, the grass is brighter green where it flowed. There's always the sign left in our experience, the encouragement, the deepening of our faith and of our certainty. Whenever we experience that flow, that's one way of talking about the omnipresent, infinite love of the eternal. Another one is when she goes into the temple that's on the hill, and in that place she's embraced. She closes her eyes and she feels herself to be embraced by Shakyamuni Buddha and recognizes, then she opens her eyes and can see that other beings in the shadows are being embraced as well. Again, as I explained it, as I understand it, at least at the present time. I'm not saying it's the only way to understand it, by the way, but at the present time I find it helpful to see it as being, you know, that within the darkness, the stillness of meditation, darkness meaning obscurity to the intellect, but not obscure to faith, to the quiet light of faith, that sense of the coming together, that certainty, the coming together of our need and the compassion and love of the eternal and the wisdom of the eternal. Another one was, this is all in one vision, where Shakyamuni Buddha is out in the boat, you know, and checking out the lotus buds, you know, and paying very careful attention to them. And remember I talked about that in terms of how even whether we're aware of it or not, the Eternal is always looking after us with infinite care. Is one of the great, I just say one of the great experiences of my life in 1998, 99, to be have my eyes open to that. And not in this way, but open to it in a way that was just, I could just see the hand of the Eternal in everything. And the incomprehensible, detailed care. What are all these things that have in common? They're all love. It's all about love. You are never separate from the love of the Eternal, however you may feel, whatever you may think. Nor is anyone else or anything else. My pure land will not be destroyed, even though beings may see it as utterly consumed by fire, letting their minds be filled with grief and horror, distress and fear. Those lines from the scripture on the immeasurable life of the Tathagata, for me that's the very heart of that scripture. My pure land will not be destroyed. What is the pure land? It's nothing less than the love of the Eternal. We live within that love. We inhale it and exhale it. Whether we are aware of it or not, whether we are aware of it or not, depends on the state of our training and the accumulation of merit. But whether we are aware of it or not, it is. To be in hell is to not know this love. To be in heaven is to know it. Therefore, a person can be in heaven spiritually even when their body is in a kind of hell. And there are ample descriptions in the history of religion and just in the general history of mankind of people who achieve this blessed state, is all I can call it. I remember when I was a boy reading a story, a true story, written by an eyewitness, a man who spent many years in one of the gulags in Siberia, or I think in a number of the gulags, but in one of them there was three, they were probably Orthodox nuns. Russian Orthodox nuns. There were three nuns who were, for some reason, they were in this gulag. I mean, maybe they were Catholic nuns. Maybe that's how they ended up there. But a lot of men and women ended up in these places. And they were hells, you know. They were hells. Millions died in them. And these three women refused to go along with something. I think it might have been just that they wouldn't work on Sunday or something like that. They refused to go along with something. And they were punished by being put out in the cold, Siberian cold, you know, like below zero, way below zero. And they stood out together in this cold and they sang. And they were not hurt by the cold. They were not hurt by the cold. They did not die. they were not hurt by the cold, and that, and after some time of this, they were, I don't think they were given any food or anything. I think it went on for some days. They took them back in, and they did not work on Sunday or whatever it was, and they were like, everyone just the camp guards and people just treated them with awe and respect. And there are similar stories of people in concentration camps, these nightmarish concentration camps, these utter hells that people made for one another, of people who simply transcended the hell they were in and behaved as angels, bodhisattvas in the midst of it, with serenity, with peace, with compassion, generosity. You know, the ultimate hell is the hell that we make for ourselves, and the ultimate heaven is the heaven that we make for ourselves. That is why, at the deepest level, our teachings speak of heaven within the heart, not as some kind of external heaven. That's nothing against external heaven. More power to them. You know, and I'm always happy if I experience any little bit of heaven. And I've noticed it never lasts. And it's okay that it doesn't last. There's something more important and more real. In the teachings on reharmonization with the eternal, there's another meaning of heaven. And I just want to talk about that here for a moment. There are always two poles in this teaching. One of them I've described in these talks as the pole of the help of the eternal. One position up top of the help. The other position down below of the need. When we talk about the five columns, this is a very important basic way to approach the five columns. Help, the help up at the top, the need down at the bottom. And this unity that joins the two. The two are two poles of one unity. The need side is the me side. You know, the help side is the eternal side. And however much it may look like, the need is never really separate from the help. As the Buddha nature embraces, includes everything. In the teachings on reharmonization, the top, the help side is often referred to as heaven, and the need side is often referred to as earth. Heaven and earth. So heaven, in the teachings on reharmonization, heaven and earth are being harmonized. Brought into harmonization with one another. Again, when we get into the discussion of the five columns, this distinction between what you might call the realm of the eternal up at the top and the realm of our karmic need at the bottom is a very helpful distinction to make. Like any other distinction, like any other concept, one cannot push it too far. And I say that because I just want to remind people from time to time that there's always more to this teaching then can be expressed or understood intellectually. It can be expressed in words or understood. Each time that one talks about it, well, one takes one's best shot at the time. And I'm always aware that there's always more to it. And I'm always just scratching the surface of it. Just scratching the surface, trying to show something of the beauty and the wonder and above all the truth of it. And when it's always just the tip of the iceberg. That's a wonderful thing about the Buddhist teachings. You come to them the same old thing again and again, and it's new, and it's seen with new eyes and with a new sense of wonder and amazement at its depth, its profundity. Okay. Buddha, Siddhartha.